Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Monday, February 3rd, and I'd like to open an organizational meeting. Sandy, do you want to let us know anything we need to know before we adopt the committee rules?
No, the committee rules are pretty standard. I think the only thing that might, hopefully you guys have been apprised to it earlier, is the 24-hour on the amendments.
1 hour.
1 hour.
1 hour, excuse me, yes. It was 24, 1 hour. I'm sorry. I knew there was an hour in there.
Okay.
Everything else.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2-3-14.
Senator Crew moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2-3-14. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close. I'd like to introduce our committee members. Start with you, Senator Canove. So say who you are.
Senator Canope.
I think the nameplate's kind of doing for us, Madam Chair, but I'm Senator Steiner Hayward. As far as I'm reading my nameplate, and that's who it says I am, so I think we're all good.
Well, Senator Canope is from Bend and has a very strong interest in health care, and I'm so glad he's on the committee. And Senator Steiner Hayward is the physician, and I'm just, we can't live without her. She's just been invaluable. And then Senator Scio.
Senator Scio. I'm Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland.
And he has he runs an office, medical office.
Used to, actually.
Used to. Oh, you're out of that business now?
I am.
Got fired?
Yeah, got canned. I'm also a social worker by training.
Okay. Senator Cruz?
Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Southern Oregon, just simple country boy.
Okay. And Sandy is our very competent administrator, and it's really important for those of you who have bills to make sure that you are working with her. She knows when things are going to be scheduled. Any amendments should really preferably go through her, because we can track them a whole lot faster, and it's more efficient in getting them here. We have Jacob, is it Vogel?
Vogely,
who is our new committee assistant.
I'm just finishing up at Portland State. My
bachelor's
degree is
global
science.
Great. Welcome aboard. Fabulous. You want to introduce? Patsy's mentoring. Okay. All right. With that, I'll close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting. Sandy, let's start with relating to dentistry. And do you have the people who are coming up?
I know that
Senator Girard, please come forward. George, is there anyone else on this one?
And then Board of Dentistry is.
Oh, and Patrick Brent.
Bratz,
I mean. You can.
Chair Mona Sanderson and colleagues, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent Senate District 9. I'm also a licensed dentist in the state of Oregon, although I have kind of retired this year. There is a problem in the dental community, and it's kind of a strange problem, and it has to do with autoclaves. Autoclaves are how we sterilize our instruments. There was a scare down in Oklahoma, and that problem in Oklahoma, the dentist or the oral surgeon was only doing cold sterilization. This is way beyond that. This has to do with autoclaves and how we deal with autoclaves. In the old days, and I'm sure Senator Mona Sanderson remembers, we used to put tape around the instruments when it went through the autoclaves. When the tape changed, then you were pretty well assured that it had gone through the autoclaves. Now we have bags, and the bags, there's little emblems on the bags that tell you when it's been through the autoclave. However, there are circumstances, and it's pretty rare, that the tape will change, but the autoclave really hasn't done everything that's totally to make it sterile. And so what we do now is what they call a spore test. Spores are the hardest thing to kill. So we get little strips that have spores on them. We run it through the autoclave. Then almost all of us send those strips to OHSU, and we get a document back from OHSU telling us that we have autoclave that works. The question is, how often do you do this process? Now, the board has done by administrative rule that it should be done once a week. There are most dentists, or I'll leave that to, for George to talk about, are doing it maybe once a month. The process the board has taken is that even if you had a billing complaint, they want your spore records now. And it's been very lucrative for the board. The fines run, if you are in noncompliance, you're going to be in noncompliance for a fairly long period of time. The maximum fine is $6,000, but it's $6,000 per clinic, per dentist. So oral surgeons who oftentimes have two or three people in their clinic and also have two or three clinics, that could be ninefold that amount. So it's a tremendous amount of money. And so this bill is trying to clear up the mess, because these dentists have been cited for being in noncompliance for spore testing, but they have records from OHSU saying that their spore records are fine. So OHSU is in a legal liable situation as well. So this bill does three things. One is it sets in statute that you must spore test every week. So it agrees with the board that you have to spore test once a week. Two, the people that got hit early, the records are expunged in the with the amendment, the money would be returned. And three, it gives OHSU a shield from legal liability. And that's basically what the board does, or what this bill does. I think it's an important bill within dentistry. The Dental Association, as George will attest to, supports this bill, and it will put us in compliance with the board. It's awful hard as a dentist when you are trying to do everything humanly possible and you think that you're in the right, and then to find out that the board has made changes that put you in noncompliance. But by doing this, I think it'll put everybody on the same page, and it will protect those people that got the fines. Now, also, not only are they fined, but this goes on their record. So you can imagine someone that's an oral surgeon, for example, that would have a record that they did not do the proper spore testing. A lot of people jump to the conclusion that this is, you know, that they were contaminated with AIDS, or that these instruments were not sterile. And this does not. This is just the test for the machine. This isn't that they were ever exposed to anything whatsoever. So by doing this, I think we represent the public by setting the standard at once spore testing every week, and those people that happen to come under compliance early, they'll be rectified. And I just think that I've seen that as someone that is on Ways and Means, that within boards, lots of times boards get real aggressive. And this, to me, is to a certain extent, and I know that we have other people who are going to disagree, but to a certain extent, it's a money grab. And I just really feel that we need to change that. So I'll let George talk a little bit, and then I'll be willing to answer any questions.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association in support of Senate Bill 1519. I'd like to start by just apologizing. I think as we start session, we're working out all the bugs. I wasn't able to print my testimony, so I'm going to testify from my computer today. So at least it's green. So. Hope that's okay with you. In 2004, the Oregon Board of Dentistry started requiring that dental office sterilizers be monitored weekly. And then last year, the board updated the rule to require retention of those records of these weekly tests for the current year plus the previous 2 years. And although the rule has been in place since 2004, the board has only recently begun asking for spore testing records when they receive a complaint. And unfortunately, many of the dentists that we represent are not doing spore testing on a weekly basis, but do sterilize their equipment, and I think that's an important distinction. Oregon dentists are leaders in the dentistry field. You know, we attend conferences across the country. We've received numerous awards from the American Dental Association for forward thinking, for advocacy in healthcare. We remain committed to promoting the highest standards of oral health and oral health care to the public, which is why, as a result, we're not here to justify a single action by one member or another, but really to say, you know, what's the bigger question? If a large majority of our dentists are not spore testing on a weekly basis, is there a bigger systematic problem? You know, this isn't about a single malicious intent by one or two dentists not to comply with the rules. We believe the Board of Dentistry does take its role in protecting the public very seriously, but may be overreacting against all licensees instead of working with the stakeholders to try to come up with a solution. In terms of communications to licensees, dentists have only received 3 notices in the past 9 years of the weekly spore testing. It's not included in risk management classes. And when we did a survey of students coming out of the dental school, very few, you know, starting dentists knew of this rule. So recognizing that this is a big problem, systematic problem, last fall the Oregon Dental Association began a comprehensive education campaign around the issue. We've sent emails, written articles for our membership magazine. We've included links in our e-newsletter, written letters to all of our members, and we even went as far as hiring temps to come in, set up a little call center at the association office to call every member in Oregon. We're continuing to revamp our models of communication so that, you know, this doesn't happen again. You know, we're also very a strong supporter of our docs communicating with the board about issues that happen in the offices. And as you remember, this committee passed, you know, Senate Bill 483, the governor's proposal about encouraging, you know, mediation and self-reporting. We found, talking to a lot of our members, that this has been kind of a dampening effect and people don't want to call the board about issues. So, you know, we're very concerned about that. We, as Senator Drudd does, the bill does 3 things. It puts into statute very clearly that we support weekly spore testing. You know, that's an important statement. There are a lot of states that don't do any spore testing or have no requirements. You know, it is a CDC recommendation, so I think that's an important clarification. Even Washington doesn't do spore, have requirements. And like I said before, there is a difference between sterilizing your equipment and keeping records about testing the equipment. And this is, again, we think spore testing serves as an important stopgap to make sure that the sterilizing equipment is working. But patients simply may not understand the difference between the punitive measures taken regarding spore testing regulations versus the perception of a dental office that doesn't sterilize his equipment. That's why it's important that we do create some sort of expungement from the website or something like that. And lastly, most dentists really actually don't do the spore testing in their offices. They contract out to outside vendors. I handed out this certificate. This is most of the docs that I talk to work with OHSU. This is the certificate that OHSU does send our dentists, so it creates a very misleading misunderstanding amongst our docs who read this and say, you know, that they're currently in compliance. And so there has been some talk about talking to lawyers and a potential lawsuit, and we actually have a great partnership with OHSU, and so support the language in the bill that deals with the liability provision. And I understand, I just saw the -1 amendment, which cleans up the liability protections, and we support the -1 as well. So thank you for taking the time, and we are happy to work with you.
Let's hear from the Board of Dentistry. Patrick.
Thank you, Senator Sanderson. For the record, my name is Patrick Brotz. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. In 2003, the Center for Disease Control changed the guidelines for monitoring heat sterilizers of dental instruments from monthly to weekly. May 13, 2004, the Oregon Board of Dentistry held a public rulemaking hearing on the changes from weekly to comply with those new CDC guidelines. At that time, all 6,004 licensees were notified by U.S. mail of the public rulemaking hearing. That was the process that was used back in 2004. On May 14, 2004, happens to have been my birthday, I'm not sure why, but the Oregon Board of Dentistry adopted the proposed rules, and they were made effective June 1 of 2004. The printed document that we refer to in our business called the Dental Practice Act is this document here. This document was then updated and revised. It's been updated and revised 16 times since June 1 of 2004, and it has been available for all of the licensees. We've literally printed thousands of them. Today, we don't print as many of them because we have computers, so we have them in a PDF format, and we actually put them on CD-ROM. But the spore testing requirements have been in this book since 2004. On July 26, 2012, the OBD did an on-site inspection of a Lake Oswego dental office following a complaint from a temporary employee that this office was allegedly not in compliance with infection control procedures. And so you understand there's more than just spore testing in our infection control rules. The investigated note and document, and I'm going to quote from the record, that you were not sterilizing XCP bite blocks and film holders, that you reused single disposable impression trays, that you did not clean and sterilize metal impression trays, and that you reused single disposable isolate suction attachments, and that between August 3, 2011 and June 6, 2012, you failed to do weekly spore testing on steam autoclave PNC Delta XL. Following that, the board decided that, as they do in all of its complaints, when a complaint is filed, we write to the licensees and ask them for some information. We ask them, for example, if they haven't recently been audited in their CE to provide CE documentation. We ask, per the legislature, do they have an amalgam separator installed? Is it properly maintained? So at this point, we decided to start asking, are you doing your weekly spore testing? To date, 37 completed investigations. Now, these are not investigations just into spore testing. These are investigations that came in as complaints about anything involving the issue of spore testing have been presented to the board, and the following are some of the findings. Licensees were either in total compliance or had a few misses with the weekly spore testing requirements. Licensees who were not in compliance with the weekly spore testing guideline requirements were also not in compliance with the previous 2003 guidelines of monthly testing, with one exception of those 37 investigations. In April of 2013, the Oregon Board of Dentistry sent out a blast email to over 7,000 of our licensees, because we have about 7,000 email addresses. In May of 2013, the Oregon Dental Association also sent out blast emails to their membership. During investigations, at least two licensees who acknowledged that they received these blast emails in April and May did not begin weekly spore testings until October of 2013. Some notable cases of licensees of those 37 cases who were disciplined include a licensee who failed to do any spore testing for calendar year 2012. None. And a licensee who was an oral maxillofacial surgeon who only did 5 tests out of a possible 52 tests. These disciplinary actions are, as required by federal law, have been reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank, are permanent records, and cannot be removed without federal law change. There's also a case that the board is still under, it's not under investigation, we're still in negotiations, where someone actually forged their spore testing results and submitted the forged documents to the board. We hope the members of the committee now understand more completely the issues surrounding the enforcement of infection control rules. We look forward to working with you and the dental community to continue the mission of the Oregon Board of Dentistry concerning the protection of the citizens of Oregon. And I did email this, but I don't know if you got it in time or not. If not, I have written copies.
I think it's in.
Okay. I was a little late in getting it out, so I apologize. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions?
I'd like to make one statement.
Yes.
This bill has nothing to, if they're in noncompliance with sterilization other than the spore test, they're in noncompliance. This just deals with the autoclave issue and spore test. So if you're not sterilizing your bite box correctly, they have they're perfectly justified to do what they're doing. This just deals with autoclave testing and how often you need to test the autoclave.
Well, the CDC guidelines recommend it be done weekly. And
bill puts it in weekly by statute. You have it by administrative rule. You unilaterally did it, and most of the dentists didn't get the message.
Well, Madam Chair, we didn't unilaterally did it. We did it the way we do administrative rules. We did a public notice. We notified all 6,000 people back in 2004 of that notice, and it's been in the Practice Act ever since. And it's a question regarding infection controls. Now, Oregon didn't have to do weekly spore testing and didn't have to do monthly spore testing as a requirement. That was in place long before I ever joined the board. There's a number of things that Oregon requires out of the CDC guidelines. For example, in Oregon, it's required that you wear gloves. It's required that you wash your hands between patients. And the example I gave to you from the doctor in Lake Oswego was to show you not only was spore testing not being done, and when spore testing is not being done, you see there are other things that are not being done as well. And that's why the board is concerned.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bratz, I wasn't quite clear on one thing from your testimony. Were there any dentists who weren't compliant with spore testing and that was the only problem that they and that the investigation ended up saying was a problem, that none of the other issues turned out to be legitimate?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, yes, there are some cases where the allegation was, let's say, my crown wasn't properly attached. After reviewing that and reviewing the records for CE, reviewing the amalgam separator, then yes, we found out there were violations in the spore testing. That is correct.
But nothing else?
But nothing else, at least from that investigation.
Understood. Follow up, Madam Chair, if I may. And how many cases are there that ultimately, with the final finding of the board, was that the only violation was the frequency of the spore testing?
Chair Anderson, Senator Steiner, out of the 37 we have now, there probably are four or five that were not. There were other things in addition besides the spore testing. So about 33 or 34 of them.
Okay. A comment, if I may, Madam Chair. I appreciate both sides of this argument pretty well, as you can imagine. I hear about these issues, people's concerns about the medical board, not infrequently. I also understand the challenges of disseminating new information. I get frustrated as heck when I hear about colleagues who are doing things, practicing in ways that have been evidence-based proven not to do it. It's also really, really tough as a doctor or a dentist to keep up on changes like this. And I frankly cannot tell you that I've read the Medical Practice Act. At this point, I'm probably going to go back and do it. But I haven't read it probably since I got licensed in 1992, and that was a really long time ago. So I guess I understand your position, Mr. Bratz, and I understand yours, Dr. Gerard, Mr. Okulich. It's tough because I do think that there's this communication issue, and it sounds as if with a very few exceptions, like the person who wasn't doing any testing for a year, that's problematic, to say the least. But that most of the people were trying to comply at some level, and that it wasn't actually a patient safety issue. It, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that any patients were harmed by this failure to test. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, we have no information that anyone was not harmed. The issue is that if the spore test isn't being done during that week or a couple of weeks, and patients become sick, they could be sick, they don't have to necessarily get HIV, they don't have to get hepatitis C, we have no way of knowing that because there was no indication that they went back to the doctor's office and said, you know, I recently saw you and I got this really bad infection while I was there. We have no evidence of that. But that's why the spore testing is done as a precautionary method.
I guess I have to say it's really tough to ever prove a negative. So I'm not sure I ultimately know what the right answer is about the expungement issue. I think certainly putting this into statute is a good idea. I don't think everybody seems to agree with that. I understand your concern about what you can or cannot take out of the National Practitioner Data Bank. That's a federal issue. It's a huge problem in the healthcare industry, but how do we disseminate new information effectively? Because we have not yet figured out that problem, and having fights like this just demonstrates more than anything what a huge problem this is and how much more of it's going to be a problem down the road.
Would you look at any amendments, especially regarding the expungement issue?
I'll look at any amendments. I would like to take care of this issue, but I think the expungement issue is probably the most important for the dentists that I talk to that have been fined. The fine, most dentists can afford a $6,000 fine, but to have it on their record that they didn't spore test at a frequent enough interval, that's really hard for them because, especially oral surgeons, it looks like they're using non-sterile instruments. They can be using the best protocol in the world. And to say that if they didn't do a spore test only once a month, that and they were supposed to do it four times a month, that they were exposed to HIV during that the three that they didn't test is absolutely ludicrous, because the fourth, they got a test that said the machine worked. So, you know, I mean, it's I can't agree with the board on that. So I understand if there is a federal issue on expungement, then we need to do that. But we have an overly aggressive board in dentistry right now, and it happens on a lot of boards. And I think that they just need to be put in their place.
I would like clarification regarding the constitutionality or from the federal standpoint on expungement.
Well, I would, too. I've never heard of that.
Well, Madam Chair, the federal data bank, we cannot remove things from the data bank. There's no law that would allow us to do that. I mean, we have discussions with the data bank all the time regarding things that we place in the data bank. And even if the board expunges something, there will always be a record in the data bank there that they just don't give up. Those are federal rules. Now, statewide, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. That's something you'd have to ask your legislative counsel or the Attorney General's office.
Okay. Looks like there's no further question. There's no one else signed up to testify, correct?
Correct.
I need to talk with you.
Okay.
After Tuesday.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. With that, I will close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1519, and we'll go to informational hearing on Senate Bill 1539. And Rose, Englert, Ann Murray, and John Powell. I guess Ann should start it off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ann Murray with Bristol-Myers Squibb. And before you, Senate Bill 1539 deals with step therapy, the issue of step therapy, sometimes referred to as a fail-first program, whereby a health plan or insurer will require a patient to try and fail a particular medication prior to the time that they would be entitled to get a medication that their prescriber initially prescribed for them. Those steps can be could be one drug, could be a combination of drugs, could be multiple drugs. Senate Bill 1539 does not prohibit that practice, does not prohibit insurance plans from utilizing that that type of a utilization management control, but does say, does require that the plan disclose a clear and concise procedure by which the physician, the prescriber, will be able to obtain the medication that he or she believes is the best for their patient under certain circumstances. And that starts on the bottom of page one and goes over to the top of page two. Those circumstances are when, in fact, the physician or the prescriber is able to prove by sound clinical evidence that the required drug in the step therapy protocol has been ineffective in treating the patient, is likely to be ineffective in treating the patient based on the known history of that patient or the known effects of the drug regimen itself, or that that drug will cause or is likely to cause an adverse reaction or physical harm to the patient. So again, not prohibiting the step therapy, but requiring a prescriber to actually prove A, B, or C before they're entitled to that override, if you will, or a skipping of the steps to the drug that they believe is in the best interest of their patient. So the bill tries to really ensure access to the most appropriate medication from the get-go, recognizing that it's never more cost effective to start a patient on something that's not going to work for them or potentially would result in harm to the patient. And a number of times what we're seeing is that it's taking 3, 4, 5, or 6 trips back to the plan to actually figure out whether or not a particular product is available for a patient. And this bill seeks to make sure that that process, those criteria are disclosed to the prescriber from the onset. There are a couple of amendments that we recommend, a couple based on drafting issues, and then there is a component in the bill that actually mandates or specifies a duration of those particular steps, indicates that the step could be no more than the time that the physician actually determines is reasonable, or 30 days, recognizing that that 30 days may be as arbitrary as, let's say, a 90-day period that a plan may have in place right now. So we're open to and working to figure out some language with regard to the duration component of each one of those steps that may be in that step therapy protocol. So there is still work to do, and we are engaged in that.
And are those memos out? Or
we just submitted the request form, Madam Chair.
And if you get them back, then make sure you get them too.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rose Englert. I work with CARE Oregon. We are fully at risk for the pharmacy for the CCOs of Columbia Pacific and Jackson Care Connect. We also work to manage the pharmacy for Yamhill CCO, and we partner with HealthShare of Oregon, managing 110,000-plus lives within HealthShare. We also work with Oregon's Health Co-op on their pharmacy. Currently, plans, if drugs are known to be ineffective or harmful to patients, we certainly don't want those going to patients, and they're generally not part of a step therapy plan or on our prescription drug list. We are in opposition to this bill. There are current law regarding pharmacy and step therapy already requires that we have the ability to override or have edits that the prior authorization or step therapy protocols can be overridden or exceptions can be made, and we do accept those from physicians. The legislation is not needed. We believe it would unnecessarily take away some of the needed processes that we do have for drug utilization review and prior authorization, and it could significantly drive up the costs to CCOs without actively looking into what we know are evidence-based remedies that need to be tested to stay within our global budgets. Thank you for the opportunity.
Ready?
Yeah. And thank then, Ann, if you want to.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, before you, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. The bill in its current form, Madam Chair and members of the committee, would simply allow the prescriber to set the parameters for any kind of step therapy, particularly on page 2, line 5, where it simply states the duration of the step therapy required by health care coverage plan may not exceed the longer of the period deemed necessary by the prescribing practitioner, and or 30 days, whichever is longer. And while we search for a solution to those issues, we think that those parameters are exceedingly brief. If you take a cholesterol drug, for example, it takes much more time than just a few weeks to determine whether or not that drug is being effective. So there are many drugs. Regents members alone save $15 million a year due to step therapy just on stomach acid drugs. So what you're dealing with here is millions and millions of dollars over time. The health plans at Regents, we have about 50 medications that require step therapy, 50 out of hundreds and hundreds of medications. So this is not applied to just create a roadblock to prescribing physicians. It is applied only after our own physicians and pharmacists spend a lot of time in searching clinical evidence. And other drugs that are in a step therapy protocol are not there just based on cost alone. They're there based on clinical evidence that these drugs perform well in these conditions. The literature reviews and are done with people at doctoral levels, not clerical people. So these issues are taken very, very seriously by the health plans. And we would just urge caution, Madam Chair, in this time when we're trying to get control of health care costs, that we do not something that would take the lid off one of the fastest growing areas of healthcare cost, and that is pharmaceuticals. Thank you.
Questions? No? Do you have any more comments?
No. Sure.
Yes.
I appreciate it, Madam Chair. If anything in my comments implied that we are suggesting, or that I am suggesting, that a health plan would require a patient to take a drug that is dangerous from the beginning, then I misspoke. What I believe I said was that in a particular situation, a drug that is required as step one may be dangerous for a particular patient. And the only person who actually has that information, or the best person to know that fact, is the prescriber who's actually treating the patient to begin with. So from a danger standpoint or a safety standpoint, it's obviously patient specific. And while the protocols may be required, and while insurers or plans may be required to have them, it is increasingly more difficult for prescribers to know what they are up front. They may, in fact, submit a particular prior authorization request in a step therapy protocol and find out that, they've achieved step one, but they need to show something else for step two to be able to obtain the drug that they actually are prescribing in the first place. That could come back and ask for a third requirement. That could come back and ask for a fourth requirement. So what we're suggesting is that there needs to be a clear and concise pathway from the beginning so that physicians actually know, prescribers actually know what information it is they need to submit. Because every time that delay occurs, you extend not only the hassle factor for the physician, but you extend the time between the patient actually being able to obtain treatment, diagnosis, and the treatment, leading to potential complications, them getting the drug somewhere else, like the emergency room, if in fact they go and ask to be treated there or seek treatment there, or have non-compliance issues or non-adherence issues because they're not taking the product, which I know you've all heard horror stories about what can happen in that case. So we're looking to make sure that patients get treated from the beginning with the right medication, and are not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that step therapy is not an appropriate method of controlling utilization. We just want to make sure that it's used properly and not as a barrier as we see it being used today.
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the concern about the clarity of the plans and making sure those are communicated pretty well, because it's tough for everybody when, you know, we're working with 8 different insurance plans at minimum, and sometimes even they're different for different plans on the same carrier. And I get that. And I think there's a lot to be said for that part of this bill. The other pieces I'm a little more dubious about as a physician. For example, 30 days for an antidepressant, you know, as Mr. Powell said, certain drugs take longer to work and longer to determine, and sometimes you have to slowly increase the dose to do it properly. It can be tough when we have a patient, because we have direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals in this country, it can be tough when you have a patient who's coming in basically insisting that you give them a certain drug for this particular condition, even if as a physician I know that the evidence shows that the best thing for this patient, the right first-line drug for this patient, is something else altogether, mm-hmm. and that the drug that they're asking for is a third or fourth-line drug. Sometimes it's actually really helpful to me as a physician to have the backup of, your insurance plan won't let me. And I don't mean it in a bad way, Mr. Powell, you appreciate it, but we're asking our insurance plans, our CCOs, to work with us to use the best evidence to control costs in appropriate ways, in ways that don't harm patients, that help patients, that make sure we're using the right drug at the right time. And I worry a little bit about, in fact, based on the conversation we had on the previous bill, it's hard to disseminate information to lots and lots of providers really quickly and make sure that everybody's up to date on the most recent evidence. Hypertension guidelines just changed dramatically late last year. And what's a first-line drug for hypertension is very different than it was before those new guidelines came out. So I guess I'm a little worried about leaving that solely in the hands of physicians or with a minimum of 30 days. evidence basis for practice, from my perspective, is really important. It's more important than ever. And I worry a little bit about this because patients don't understand sometimes why the drug that they want is not the right drug for them and why it might take longer for a drug to work. I don't have any problem, I don't think, unless I'm missing something, with making protocols and plans clear. That seems pretty reasonable unless I'm missing something. Am I, Mr. Powell?
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner-Hayward, no, we would agree that health plans should make their protocols very clear. And, you know, we do have edits and ways of overriding the prescribed drugs. So we have no problem with a requirement to make it clear. I think we would agree with your summation that to allow just the prescribing physician to set the timeline is unreasonable.
And that's not what it says. Right now it's got this 30-day number, and I get that. But overall, I guess, to my mind, I'd like to see if there really is a problem and maybe start by just making sure that the protocols are really clear. If we want to move something forward, let's make sure everybody's playing by the same rules, that everybody knows what the rules are, and then see whether that decreases the problems that some people are seeing with this, and then we can come back and revisit this in a year if it turns out that we haven't really solved the problem. But I think we're making a lot of efforts to provide the most evidence-based care, and that's kind of how I think about it, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I appreciate your concern, and as I said in my opening comments, that 30 days was more of a placeholder, if you will, in terms of trying to figure out what that language or what that durational component really is. And is it all up to the physician? Probably not, and we're not suggesting that it need be, but at the same time, we want to make sure that in the situations where the physician has evidence and has a case to override it, that he or she be allowed to do so. Currently, right now, we're looking at an arbitrary 90 days for many plans. That doesn't make a lot of sense either. There are plenty of drugs that you can figure out long before 90 days that they don't work for a patient.
Sure.
And so it's somewhere between, perhaps, but obviously maybe not an arbitrary time limit, but more along the lines of what the evidence actually shows.
Thank you.
Seeing no further comments, thank you, panel. With that, I'll close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1539 and open a informational hearing on Senate Bill 1548 relating to mid-level health care practitioners. Jack Dempsey. Elizabeth. You're not on the list.
That's right. You didn't.
I should.
No. Remley.
Okay. I was like, I don't think I'm fancy got anything today.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley, here representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. OSPA represents physician assistants in the state of Oregon on professional matters. OSPA's had several reports over the last couple of years of a lot of folks misinterpreting statute where it's written ambiguously or too broadly, or may only reference physicians when really it's pretty obvious that the intent in the statute is that it's about anybody's provider. And so, for example, we had an issue with the Family Leave Act. It had a list of providers that included a whole host of different kinds of healthcare practitioners, but inadvertently left off physician assistants. And in that process, if somebody had submitted a medical necessity report for the Family Leave Act and a PA had signed it, it could have been denied. I think it's just an accident. We spoke with Bowley about it. They changed their rules to include us, but we want the statute to reflect that. There are about 90 sections of statute that we identified where this kind of issue exists. And we worked with LC to figure out how to update statute to include physician assistants and nurse practitioners. And we started with those two practitioners because the Affordable Care Act identifies them as primary care providers because they're doing a lot of primary care work in the state of Oregon. They are an integral part of the healthcare workforce as we expand access. And we wanted to make sure that there weren't misunderstandings that would slow down a patient's access to their provider in the future as we move forward with expanding access. But we have a huge list of statutes that are probably written a little too ambiguously, and we'd be glad to share that with any provider group that's interested in doing something similar to what we've done for physician assistants and nurse practitioners. Our goal with this bill is not to expand scope or extend privileges to any to physician assistants or nurse practitioners. This bill, the intent here is only to reflect what's actually happening in the current healthcare arena. What I've told any stakeholder who's asked, and I've tried to reach out to a good number of folks in this room, is that if there are any concerns at all about the sections that are in this bill, we'd be glad to talk about it. If it requires more than a five-minute conversation, we'll just take it out of the bill and we'll deal with it later, because that's not what this session is about. So that's the sort of quick and dirty on this. I'll let Jack speak for a minute, but then I'll just take questions.
Madam Chair, Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon Nurses Association and our nurse practitioner members. I don't have anything more to add. I think Ms. Remley described the bill appropriately, and happy to answer any questions about any specific questions about any of the sections in here.
I know it's my bill and Senator Cruz's bill, but I would really like you to approach the hospitals and get their input on this. I know it's a 123-page bill, but just to make sure that there aren't untoward consequences with them, if you would do that, because
I have Chair Moss Anderson. I have reached out to them. I'm waiting for them to get back to me. I did send them some information about it last week, though.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
No. Bill. All right. Does anyone from the hospitals want to talk today yet? Patty?
No.
Andy? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. There's no questions.
Thank you.
I will close the public informational hearing on 1548 and open the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1565. Oh, I thought it was. It's a 68-page bill. Sorry. Jim Gardner, Thea Zajac, and B.J.
Kavner.
Madam Chair, I think I should probably go first as the intro speaker. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, in support of Senate Bill 1565. And I'm going to keep this very short because this really is a pretty straightforward bill. What it does is codifies as a matter of state law an existing provision called the anti-discrimination provision in the Federal Affordable Care Act. And you might ask, well, if that's already federal law, why do we need to do that as a matter of state law also? And the response is fairly straightforward. First, that provision becomes waivable by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in 2017. And we think as a matter of state law, it's important to ensure that that protection will continue unabated after that date of waivability occurs. The second major reason is that this would create a remedy. For instance, if a rule were promulgated in contravention of the anti-discrimination provisions, this would create a remedy under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act for challenging that rule in the Court of Appeals, or if it were another type of administrative action for challenging it in Marion County Circuit Court. That's not in the bill you're reading, but that's a consequence of how this would interact with the Administrative Procedures Act. So it creates basically a state law remedy as opposed to having to run off to federal court, and it makes it vastly more accessible for patients that are seeking that protection. We have agreed to a technical amendment with John Powell of Regents, which would have the effect of allowing age to be taken into consideration in health insurance rate making, so that you wouldn't have the rationale for that is that otherwise you could have rates face, particularly for young people, face even further upward pressure than they're going to already face. So we'll have that for your consideration as a technical amendment. Why don't I stop there and see if there's any questions?
Let's go ahead with the panel.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Thea Zajac, and I'm with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And like you, Senator Shields, I'm a social worker by trade and now find myself here advocating for patients in a different way. At Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we're advocating for blood cancer patients whose wide range of diseases really can't be prevented or screened for, and they're very dependent on the newest and most cutting-edge innovative therapies that are coming out. One of the greatest success stories that we share nationally is one that happened here in Oregon at OHSU with Dr. Brian Drucker, who helped create a treatment for a type of leukemia called chronic myelogenous leukemia, or we call it CML. The treatment has been able to help patients, one of which, Judy, she lives here in Oregon, who was diagnosed with CML in 1998. She was told she had 3 to 5 years to live. And that was with intense chemotherapy and being very sick. After a lot of chemo that she found out didn't work, you know, she was told she had no other options. And it was around this time that Dr. Drucker's treatment was going into clinical trials. And she found out about this and signed up, even though she was really sick. They told her, you know, she had months to live. That drug worked for her. She's still alive 15 years later. She lives in Lake Oswego. She takes a pill every day to remain in remission and live a normal life. I tell this story because CML is just one of many diseases. There are still other really intense cancers in the blood cancer realm that don't have this great of survival rates, and there are, you know, treatments being developed every day and treatments that already exist that are being discovered to affect other, you know, other types of cancer. And these are the people that, you know, when they're at this dire state and there's nothing else and they find something that might work, they need to be able to access those things without being discriminated against because of their potential disability that they're seen to have had, the length of life that their, you know, doctors have said that they might live. So we really, really strive to ensure that our patients, you know, have this access. And as this cancer treatment landscape continues to change, that we adapt to these new therapies and cutting-edge treatments. And it's really important that policy guidelines encourage patients with these great medical needs to have sustainable and affordable access to therapies. And this includes the ability to access coverage without being discriminated against. So thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is B.J. Kavanaugh, and I'm the Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a chronic health collaborative serving patients and organizations here in Oregon. It was not that long ago that many of the conditions we talk about today and we talk about in general were considered terminal, especially cancer, HIV, and hepatitis C. Yet today we're able to treat these patients, in some chances even cure patients from these conditions. Advances in medicine often require advances in policy. SB 1565 is one of these advances. We believe at 1 in 4 with our partners that the people that we represent, that this is an important policy and provision to put in place to protect the rights of Oregonians now and in the future. simply said, we want to make sure that when treatments are available for people, that people aren't denied life-sustaining and life-saving treatments simply because of our inability to make the correct decision now. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I had some anecdotal information given to me on this bill. It was discussed in the interim that a plan denied coverage because the doctor had stated he had less than 6 months to live. Can you follow up on that scenario?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain that I'm familiar with that particular anecdotal situation, though certainly that kind of harm or risk is one of the reasons it's important. It was important for the federal government in the ACA to codify the anti-discrimination provisions as a matter of federal law, and why it's important, I believe, for us to codify that as a matter of state law, because that would, I believe, run afoul of these protections.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the concerns that you all are raising, and I certainly think that we have to keep a certain amount of flexibility, and we all know that one 80-year-old is not like the next 80-year-old, right? So we do have to have flexibility, and having hard and fast rules can be problematic, and I get that. I'm with you on that. That being said, I guess I'm a little concerned about the breadth of this, and it, again, to go back to our conversation on the previous bill, I seem to be referring back to the previous bill every time I ask a question today. I wonder a lot about the need to promote evidence-based practice. And I also wonder with some of our cancer patients about giving false hope. I have worked with a lot of cancer patients, and I think in some ways the worst thing that we can do for them is to tell them that there's hope when maybe there isn't. The patient that you talked about, Ms. Ajak, was put on a clinical trial. That's different from accepted therapy, and I don't think there's any discrimination, any concern that there's discrimination except on the part of the investigators and their protocols and what their protocol says about who can be included. I worry also about whether this could end up being extended. I have patients, the current guidelines, for example, on pap smears, depend on whether you do automatic HPV virus testing at the time you do your pap smear and how old the patient is. There are a lot of different things, right, that affect the current evidence-based guidelines about pap smears. And yet I still have patients who want pap smears every single year, even though they haven't had one. And they're running a risk of a false positive, which is going to be incredibly traumatic and expensive. I'm concerned that when we start saying, well, we don't have to pay attention to the evidence for one thing, we don't have to pay attention to it for other things. I'm concerned about false hope, and I wonder what your thoughts are about those concerns.
But, Madam Chair, if I may, Senator Steiner-Hayward, let me see if I can narrow the policy focus here just a little bit, if I could, because I think the questions you're raising really in a sense, go to the merits of the federal anti-discrimination provision. And that is already federal law, something that exists now. And so I think, from my perspective, the real policy issue is, should that continue unabated in a non-waivable situation post 2017, number one, and number two, should there be essentially a state law remedy for an administrative rule that would run afoul of that? I think that the broader issues are perhaps not as directly implicated by this bill.
Madam Chair, if I may, unless one of you all wants to add anything to that.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Steiner, Steiner Hayward, if I may, one of the things that we're finding right now is that there are patients who are unable to access the correct medication they want to. For example, I'm thinking around the new treatment modalities around hepatitis C. They're facing barriers to being able to get these new medications, which can cure their life, cure their disease, and in many cases prevent, well, in 85% of cases cure their disease, and in many cases prevent liver cancer. And so while we're talking about this as a policy issue, we're not simply talking about giving an 80-year-old person extended chemotherapy. No one wants to give a patient false hope. And having lost two parents to cancer, I can tell you that having these decisions or these discussions with your parents is incredibly difficult and forces you to deal with your own mortality as well. But we're talking about putting policy guidelines in place to help protect patients in Oregon with access to current treatment and therapy and future therapy.
So if I may, Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your concerns and comments. I guess then, Mr. Gardner, I would ask you this. First of all, the waivability period doesn't expire for another 3 years. We've got two more legislative sessions between now and then to get a sense of how often those protections are being invoked by patients. We also have made a decision as a state. Sometimes we have statute that copies federal law, but a lot of times there are federal laws that we, I think, reasonably choose not to duplicate. Don't ask me offhand to think of one, but I think we all know that there are many. And I'm a little concerned about taking this step well before it's needed and when we already have a track record of not necessarily, rarely, I would say, my gut is rarely duplicating federal law on a state basis. You guys know me well enough to know by now I'm kind of a minimalist when it comes to statute, and I don't like, we've got the protection in place right now. I don't think the federal courts are dramatically less accessible, and I sincerely hope that nobody who's really being harmed by this has to take this to the federal court level, because that's going to, and even the state court level would take this a while to get through. So I don't know if there's a response to that per se, but I'm expressing my concerns based on those two perspectives. I don't want people being denied treatment that's appropriate for them. Don't get me wrong. But I worry, again, just as I did with the last bill, about how we get to those places.
Yeah. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Hayward, if I may briefly respond, I would respectfully disagree in terms of the timing. I think that the right time to create these protections is before there is a crisis on the horizon. I think the time is now. I would respectfully disagree with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other discussion, thank you, panel, for being here. And I will close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1565 and open a informational hearing on Senate Bill 1579. And let's start out with Senator Bates. And Craig, and Jennifer.
We're all signed in.
Yep. And I...
Dennis McMahon.
Dennis, okay, great.
Well, hell and hello.
Hello.
Good to see you again.
Yeah.
I'm going to let my esteemed colleagues on the right start this bill out, and then I'm going to try to bring it home. I'm, for the record, just to get it out of the way, I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm from the southern part of the state, and I'm also in private practice as a primary care physician.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in support of Senate Bill 1579 with the -1 amendments. The bill is fairly simple and straightforward. What it does is it allows a physician, a patient, and a pharmacist to come up with a synchronization plan so that a person who has chronic health conditions can come up with a plan where they come in once a month or once every 2 weeks or however it works out between those three entities to make sure that all of the prescriptions are being filled at one time so that the person doesn't have to make multiple trips back and so that it's much easier to keep track of the prescriptions themselves, make sure that there aren't conflicts amongst the prescriptions, that the prescriptions are there ready to be filled when they come in. and to make sure that the individual isn't themselves having to track multiple prescriptions, making sure that they know which ones they're coming in on that particular day to fill. For some, I won't comment on the number of pills I get that taking every day, but it does become confusing if they're not all in one place at one time. And something like this will be very helpful to the patient, let alone for the pharmacist and for the physician. I will explain very quickly what the amendment does, because the bill in its original form was a little overreaching in that it would allow the synchronization plan to trump a plan when dealing with refill restrictions, and there are very good reasons to have those refill restrictions. So that provision within the bill has been struck, as has the definition of refill restrictions. So that is no longer in the bill once the dash ones are amended, and we would strongly suggest that amendment be made to the bill. I can certainly go on, but I have a general rule, never talk longer than the bill itself is, and I do want to comment. I'm very thankful that a previous panel didn't follow that rule to its maximum conclusion with 68 pages of bill to talk about.
Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to provide remarks today. My name is Dennis McDaney. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Bioscience Association. We, too, are speaking in support of Senate Bill 1579. As already described, it's a marvelous way for a patient to be able to create a synchronization plan between their team of healthcare providers. Oregon Bioscience supports this bill because the legislation strongly encourages patients to increase adherence to their medication, resulting in better outcomes and disease management, lower hospitalizations, and it ultimately reduces costs to our Oregon health system. Oregon Bio also strongly believes that when patients have access to medication, they're in a better position to manage their own chronic disease and stay healthier. Simply stated, when patients take their medications, they stay healthier. And anything we can do to increase that compliance, I think, we're in support of. And then I think Senator Bates will clean up, but I'm happy to answer questions at the question round.
And Madam Chair, if I might add one thing, I should have said healthcare practitioner, not physician.
That kept me out of trouble too. Thank you. I have two nurse practitioners I work for, so I have to be careful. So this is one of these bills, you know. I'm going to give a shout out to Jennifer Stoll for bringing this to me 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's rather short notice, but it was such an obvious thing I couldn't pass it up. I feel like one of the Simpsons, you know. You know, why you ever think of this? Let me kind of tell you what it's like in a practice real quickly. I know Senator Steiner Hayward knows already, but commonly what we see is that you'll get 3 or 4 calls a month on a patient who's taking 4 or 5 drugs, a specific drug that needs to be renewed, and you keep getting these calls and calls like, can't we get it together and just do them all at one time? And the other thing that starts happening is the patient comes in and you've done some labs, you're just checking, I'll give you an example, their cholesterol. And, you know, and Bob's sitting in front of you, and I said, gee, your cholesterol's really back up. Have you been taking your medication? And, you know, I ran out. I went to the pharmacy 3 times last month, and I ran out and didn't take the last one. Does it make a difference that I didn't take it for the last week? You know, and after I finished strangling the patient, out of frustration, and we have to run the test all over again in a month. You have to go back on your medications, and hopefully he's there, you know, a month later with everything taken care of. So you got an extra visit. They've been off their meds. And sometimes it can be pretty dangerous. It's more just a convenience thing. I've had patients who ran out of cardiac medications, ended up in the emergency room, ended up hospitalized, and even in ICU, just because it was so difficult to get themselves together and get to the pharmacy 3 or 4 times in 1 month. So this allows us to stop that problem. The change you'll see in the bill from the one you're reading also deals with the issue that I thought was overreaching also when I first read how it came out of LC. There are some medications you really want strict controls on because of cost or because they're narcotics, and this doesn't affect that. This allows it to be between the practitioner and the pharmacist to make these arrangements. So if it's a narcotic you need to control, you're not going to write 90 days and refill it whenever you want to. Or if it's an extremely expensive drug, and there are some rare drugs, usually cancer drugs, that are really expensive, thousands of dollars per pill. You don't want to give a 90-day supply and something like that and have the patient say, I'm not going to take the last 2 months, or something happens that they can't take it the last 2 months, and waste thousands and thousands of dollars. So I think the bill is written with the amendments is what we need to do. I know it's kind of short notice. I know this is February. It's a 4-week deal, but this is such a good idea, and other states have used it, I thought it was worthwhile to kind of break my own rules and bring a bill forward.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. Is there a definition of chronic health condition? And I ask, I mean, not earlier. It'd be kind of nice to define the universe of what we're talking about here.
Hey, I actually underlined that to myself. Okay, so I have the same concerns. I would expect, and it would be the intent, the legislative intent, that chronic health conditions, as listed in this bill, applies only to this bill. If you start thinking about chronic health conditions and defining them, which we probably should do someday, we don't want this to have ramifications on things like physical therapy, or how often you go to the hospital, or certain types of imaging that can go on. That's a very broad term, and we want to make sure that if we pass this bill, which I hope we will, that this phrase, chronic health conditions, as stated in this bill, is only for this part of this bill and nothing else.
Yeah,
we haven't defined it here clearly.
I mean, I know what you're talking about, okay?
I know when I see it.
my other question, and it's getting picky again, for some of these patients with these chronic health conditions, chances are they have more than one practitioner. Then you say practitioner. That would be the question. I mean, do you need to expand that universe a little bit? I don't know. I'm just thinking, you know, to circle through one pharmacy makes sense, but to have, you see what I'm saying? I mean, just something to think about, whether that's too narrow just in without having an S on there or something like that. Just a thought.
Madam Chair? Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. I think I've got a solution to the chronic health conditions problem. I think you could say instead of chronic health conditions developed by a patient who requires ongoing use of one or more specific medications, and then you talk about the medications and not about the health conditions. I don't have the language exactly right, but I think that might solve the problem. To think about it. Senator Cruz's point is well taken about practitioners, and frankly, that sometimes is a real issue. But boy, do I support this bill overall. This is a great bill, both as a physician and a patient. I think this is a really good bill, and I...
We're just trying to help, Doc.
Yeah. I think you could do it by defining the medications rather than the conditions. I think there's a way to phrase it that would solve it that way.
Madam Chair, this is kind of a fast delivery, so any help we can get along the way, I appreciate.
Well, there are some opponents to the bill, which I hope that they're coming up, and so I hopefully you'll take note of what they have to say, too. Any other questions? Okay. Let's have Jennifer Stoll.
The rest are opponents.
And then I think the others are opponents.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Stoll. Thank you for allowing my brief remarks today. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for Allergan. I'm supporting Senate Bill 1579 with the Dash 1 amendments. Allergan is a multi-specialty healthcare company, and we are founded on preserving and protecting patient vision with almost half of our portfolio in the eye care space, glaucoma, dry eye, and external eye disease. And we truly believe that patients who, especially when it comes to eye disease, patients who take their medication maintain their vision, and their vision becomes protected. The moment they stop taking their glaucoma drugs, there are rapid loss of vision for that patient. And that being said, a patient synchronization plan, allowing a patient to have one time or a plan where their medications all renew on one day can help patients become adherent to their medications. We, again, strongly support this legislation, and I will end my remarks now. Thank you very much.
Comments? Thank you, Jennifer. Jeremy Vandehay, and I know Rose Engler.
What, are you for Rose?
I am not Rose.
That's okay.
Really?
And then B.J. Kavanaugh, I think. Okay. All right.
Now, Chair.
BJ, are you in favor or against?
We are in favor of this.
Oh, so let him go first.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you. You have a copy of my testimony. I'm going to speak today as a patient. As a person living with a chronic health condition, which, by the way, is defined by the Centers for Disease Control as any medical condition which requires ongoing medical treatment for 3 months or more. It's the rule that we use in forming our organization. I want to tell you what a great idea this is and how much this would make life that much easier for myself and for the tens of thousands of Oregonians living with chronic health conditions. I'm a little bit type A, and so I like to make a med set once a month that puts all of my medications in place so that when I wake up, I take my meds, I have my coffee, I check my email, walk my dog, get on with my day. This week, for example, I went to refill medications. Because of the necessary changes due to new plans, because of prior authorizations, because some type of medications may require a different prior authorization or type of prescription as to others, I have to go back to the pharmacy 3 times just to get that medication filled. Now, I am very much a high-functioning patient and able to do these type of things, but to us, this is simply a no-brainer. I had the opportunity to work in a pharmacy in California, and we saw this all the time. When patients came in that had new medication changes because of complex conditions like HIV and cancer, and we were treating conditions because of lab results or changes in disease, we were able to do partial fills and keep them on track with their medications. It improved adherence, it lowered emergency room and doctor's visits cost, and it improved public health. So thank you. We very much support this. And my comments, like I said, you have in front of you.
Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am not Rose Englert. My name is Doug Riggs. I'm speaking on behalf of Rose, who had to leave to go to a medical appointment. But I'm also not here in opposition to the bill. Kerrigan supports synchronizing medication prescriptions for chronic needs and believe that that's good for our patients. So we have spoken with Senator Bates. We believe that he's working on an amendment that will make some changes. I think we had some general concerns about making sure that chronic drugs were not being abused, making sure that patients weren't pharmacy shopping, and also making sure that whatever we're going to do, we make very clear. And I think the discussion that has occurred this afternoon helps move that in the right direction. So, again, we strongly support the direction that Senator Bates is moving in, and with some changes that I think are going to be made, are going to be happily able to support the bill.
Thank you.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandy with Kaiser Permanente. Likewise, we only get so many boxes on this check-in sheet, and we don't get working
our
concerns.
No, you're against
out.
The bill. You didn't really mean it.
I don't know why I get boxed into those two categories. But likewise, just saw amendments to the bill a few minutes ago, which I think mostly address our concerns. I just want to kind of put on the record what our original concerns were, make sure we're all clear about what we think the bill does with the amendments. The bill originally would have overrided any restrictions on dosages that are dispensed. There's some very expensive drugs out there. The hepatitis C drug, for instance, is about $1,000 a capsule. We only send that out in about 7-day increments. It just would not be prudent or safe to send somebody home with $30,000 worth of drugs in their pocket. And so our original concern was that this would override that and you'd have to sync everything up with a 30-day or 60-day or whatever it was dose. It sounds like, at least talking with Senator Bates, his understanding with their amendments is this would require basically pharmacists and providers to try to sync up those dates and minimize the number of trips to a pharmacy. We wholly support that concept, and as an integrated system are able to do that already right now. So I don't think this is really a problem that's aimed at or fix the same at Kaiser. What I just want to make sure we're all clear on is that the bill coming out still would not require 30 days for every single drug. I think it's really important, both as a safety issue, primarily as a safety issue. I don't think we'd ever put $30,000 on our kitchen counter and just leave it there throughout the month. And likewise, we shouldn't do that. So, with the amendments, you know, I think a simpler fix to this would just be a requirement that providers and physicians all work together and try to minimize the trips to pharmacy. And if we could, I would be more supportive of a bill that said that. But I think our issues are mostly addressed with the amendments.
Can I ask one last question? And I don't know, I probably should have asked this of Senator Bates, but
I was thinking about it a little bit because I went through, I'm like you, I do my med set once a month and I'm done, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not a secret that I have MS and some other chronic conditions that I need to take my medications for consistently. There was a period of time when I was taking more, and I actually called up my mail-order pharmacy. This will, by the way, I think, be cheaper for mail-order pharmacies for those of us who get them that way because they don't have to pay postage four times a month. But I called up, and I worked with a very helpful pharmacy tech, and I said, okay, I've counted it out. Here's what I need to get myself all synchronized. And I just wonder about the change about not requiring plans to do something off of, I wonder if there's a way to frame it, and there may not be, but for example, say that I am adding a new antihypertensive for my patient, and I know where they are in their prescription, or they are able to tell me, could I, and the, I'm supposed to prescribe a month's worth, but I need to prescribe 37 to get them synced up. Do you know what I'm saying? I wonder if there's a way to phrase that so that I can help get them on target, because you said, you know, it'd be better if the physicians do it. We'd like to, but sometimes we're limited in our ability to do that. I don't know if anybody has any ideas, but it does occur to me.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Steiner-Hayward, one of the ways that we've done this in the past is to work with people with chronic conditions with specialty pharmacies and to include the pharmacist as the gatekeeper, knowing all the medications that the patient is taking. It allows us to, by the way, I love the idea of less mail. You've just made this a green issue as well, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. I try.
It allows the pharmacist to know when what was dispensed and additionally to pay attention to the true adherence. You may see your doctor two or three times a year, but you're often going to see your pharmacist at least once a month. Well, hopefully, if this goes through. So we can't necessarily mandate that, but we do recommend that people living with chronic conditions, whenever possible, use a single pharmacist to help manage all of the potential interactions and the changes necessary for their continued health.
Senator Bates, do you have any other comments on?
Can I get on there? Sit down before you start talking, Alan.
For the record, Alan Bates, Senator, District 3. I think the suggestions from the committee are excellent. I think Senator Cruz's suggestion to put an S on to health practitioners is great, and I think a better definition of chronic health conditions by saying, as you suggested, it just applies to medications will really work very nicely. And I think we probably can satisfy people who are concerned about expensive drugs or drugs be are short term. I think the answer for that first prescription when you're halfway through the other prescriptions is you write the prescription and then the pharmacist syncs it up the second time he fills it.
Yeah.
That's probably the best we can do.
That should be a relatively easy logistical.
Right. It's a huge change. I mean, I have 50 or 60 charts pulled every single day on patients to refill their medications, and then a week later, I see some of the same charts again pulled out or electronically pulled out to refill. It's just mind-boggling, and you think,
it's a huge waste of
time. Why couldn't we have done this once last week? And in the meantime, the patient's running back and forth and getting confused, and it's just a great idea.
Well, I think also it's not just you only having to do it once, but you're seeing everything at the same time, and if adjustments need to be made, it's an easy place to make the adjustments.
Yep. I think it's great. It's a great idea. It's not my idea, but I just couldn't figure it out myself. It's one of those moments you look at the billing and go, yeah, should have been doing it before.
Great. That's the bill number.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to close the informational hearing. And, colleagues, we meet Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, so tomorrow afternoon. And we're going to have public hearings on four bills. Senate Bill 1523, 1553, 1569, and 1526. So, any other comments? With that, I close the informational hearing and we're adjourned.